Hi, this is Christopher O'Reilly, host of From the Top. Thank you for tuning into this week's podcast. While this podcast is free for all of you, it actually costs our little nonprofit some significant resources to purchase rights for all this fabulous music. Please consider making a small gift to From the Top and keep us broadcasting loud and clear. Go to fromthetop.org and click on Support.
How do you get kids to stick with their music? Do you force them to practice? Do you let them decide? On today's show, four teenagers describe the very different ways their parents got them to pick up their instruments and put in some time. From NPR, it's From the Top, celebrating the energy of America's kids and the power of classical music. We're at the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, Indiana, where we'll also hear a 16-year-old perform music by the Czar of Cellists and a young harpist share what life is like on her Indiana farm. From the Top's home is New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall in Boston. Here's our host, one of America's great concert pianists, Christopher O'Reilly.
Thank you. Thank you and welcome. Welcome, everybody. Thank you to the Center for the Performing Arts for bringing us to this absolutely magnificent new concert hall. And when I say new, I mean brand spanking new. This place has that new hall smell. This place opened just a couple of months ago, and it's already an amazing addition to the cultural scene in the Midwest. The Center for the Performing Arts has three performance venues, including the beautiful Palladium where we're doing our show, but it'll soon also house a treasure. 35,000 square feet is about to be dedicated to a huge collection of sheet music, recordings, and memorabilia relating to the Great American Songbook. And this collection is the work of one man, the great interpreter of that songbook, Michael Feinstein. Michael is the artistic director here. We're thrilled that he's in our audience today and that he'll be coming up on stage at the end of the show to sing a Gershwin tune accompanied by some of the great kids on today's show. And speaking of great kids, let's meet one now. Please welcome, from Wilmore, Kentucky, 16-year-old cellist Matthew Liversedge. Matthew, welcome. Joanne mentioned that we would be hearing the music of the Czar of Cellists. Would you please fill our audience in?
Sure thing. The composer of the piece we're going to play was a 19th century cello virtuoso. Tchaikovsky called him the Czar of Cellists. He wrote four cello concertos, as well as the piece we're going to play tonight. It's called Am Springbrunnen, or At the Fountain, Karl Davidoff's At the Fountain.
Okay, when you're ready, we'll take it from the top. Thank you. Matthew Liversedge, 16 years old, our cellist from Wilmore, Kentucky. Quite a feat of sleight of hand there, Matthew. So subtle and just... Well, like a fountain, you know, light and effervescent, but sort of awe-inspiring at the same time. Really great. Matthew, in talking to you before the show, I loved the very original way you tied together very disparate ideas and disparate experiences, and I've got some questions to bring that out. You ready? Good for that?
Okay.
How is music... This is stuff that you said, not me. How is music like lifting weights?
If you go into a weight room with, you know, three or four other guys and you're with a lifting buddy and you're under the bench press, you'll notice oftentimes in a weight room guys are joking around. They're kidding about how much they can lift, egging each other on. But once a guy gets under that bar on the bench press and he's looking up at the weight that he's about to lift, every time his face goes serious and you can see that he's focused and that he's ready to do this thing, that he doesn't quite know how it's going to turn out. You don't know whether your body's going to support the weight. You don't know how difficult it's going to be. You don't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, I find that with music, when you're with other people, you can joke around. You can practice all you want. You can prepare for this thing. But when you sit down to play a piece, I feel that a musician becomes serious because the musician knows that he's about to start something that takes concentration, and he doesn't know where it's going to go, how it's going to end up, and he has to prepare for that, and he has to be aware of that, and so he takes it on seriously. Each time it's something new, you don't know what to expect, and that's what I think makes music so appealing.
Okay, here's another one of your disparate comparisons, something you're quite an expert on. Tell us, Matthew, how conducting is like refereeing soccer.
I began refereeing soccer 6th, 7th grade, and the connection I make with that is that a referee, many people who aren't referees would not know this, but when you're sitting center referee and you're viewing the game, you have two sideline refs who are also helping you make calls. And so you have a very difficult time of balancing your control as the central authority with the ideas of the other lesser authorities with you and monitoring the way the players are going to act. I mean, ultimately, you're not deciding how the game's going to, the players are. But you are trying to manipulate the game so that it will go in a fair manner, in a safe manner, in the way you want it to go. What it really comes down to is how you can interact with people, how you can control, and how can you think under pressure in that environment. And so in the same way, a conductor, when he goes out there, you can go to a music school, you can take lessons, you can study, but a great conductor is able to have his opinions about the music, have his leadership, and put that onto the orchestra, but also work with the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, he has to be mindful that no matter what he says, what he does, they're the ones who are making the music.
Absolutely.
So all he can do is try to guide them in the right direction and keep, you know, in the sense of the referee, keep the game going in a smooth manner. And so that's sort of why I tie those together.
Matthew, I'm very honored to be able to tell everybody that you're one of our Jack Kent Cook Young Artists, but someone, another foundation, actually discovered you the day before we gave you the news, right?
Yeah, that's correct. The day you guys called, obviously I was extremely excited to hear the news about the show and the award, but the day before that, I'd received a call from the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation in California. And they had awarded me a grant to buy a new cello. So 2 days in a row, and you know, probably two of the biggest days of my life. But they fell right there together, and it was a pretty special weekend.
Very exciting and very well deserved, and great honor to play with you.
Thanks,
Matthew.
Thank you very much.
Matthew Liversedge, 16 years old, our cellist from Wilmore, Kentucky.
There's an interactive map of America on our website where innovative arts leaders can find out about each other and share ideas. This week, our map highlight is the organization that gave Matthew his cello, the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation, which donates instruments to school and after-school music programs and to outstanding student soloists who lack the resources to buy their own. If you're changing the world through music, go to fromthetop.org and get on the map. From the Top is made possible in part by the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, advancing the education of students of exceptional promise who have financial need. On the web at jkcf.org. Chris.
Thanks, Joanne. Our second performer is the first of two Hoosiers on today's program. Please welcome from Bloomfield, Indiana, 15-year-old harpist Katie Kapelson. So, Katie, where is Bloomfield?
Bloomfield is about 45 minutes southwest of Bloomington. It's way out in the middle of nowhere.
So, Bloomington, which is already out in the middle of nowhere.
Sort of.
An hour and a half from here, actually, and then yet further down. Is there no end to Indiana? We're glad to hear it. We're going to hear a lot about your home in a minute. But, you know, this piece you're going to play is something we're used to hearing on classical guitar. Tell everybody the title of the piece.
Well, I'm going to be playing a piece called Asturias by Isaac Albanese, but Asturias makes use of a very special effect on the harp known as prêt à la tabla, which is known in English as playing near the soundboard of the harp. And by playing near the soundboard of the harp, you're cutting the string, you're making it smaller than its normal length, so it creates a guitar-like effect. So try and listen for that while I'm playing.
Actually, visually, it's sort of arresting, too, because instead of, you know, having your arms suspended in air, it's almost like you've got a hand of cards on the table, very close to that. So we're hearing more of the attack, like classical guitar, rather than the blooming of sound.
Yeah.
Stage is yours. Katie Cattleson, 15 years old, a harpist from Bloomfield, Indiana, playing Isaac Albeniz Asturias from Suite Española. I'll tell you, it's not just the technical effect of getting close to the soundboard there as far as getting that beautiful classical guitar sort of attack, but it's also the evocative nature of your playing, the great sense of shape to the phrase that you bring to it that really, really grabs our attention, really tells the story.
Thank you.
It was really quite beautiful.
Thanks.
Katie, this is what an average day in your life sounds like. So you live in a zoo? No, not really. Please explain.
Well, I live in the middle of 250 acres of protected land, and all of our farm is filled with all kinds of wildlife, including deer and wild turkeys and foxes and rabbits and all kinds of songbirds and other birds. But we also have a bunch of farm animals. We have goats and we have chickens and we have rabbits and stuff. So on our property, we also have several streams, and we have a big pond right in front of our house, and we also have a couple waterfalls, so it's really
amazing.
Neat.
Your mom says you were totally determined to get these goats that you have. Is that true?
Well, when I was 7 years old, I won a competition in Philadelphia, and I was not expecting to win this competition, but my parents like to reward me for the hard work that I put into a competition instead of just winning it. So my mom said, Katie, what would you like as a reward for working hard? And she was figuring that I would ask for something like getting my ears pierced or something. But I said, Mom, I really want a goat. And she was like, okay, well, I don't think that'll really work because our neighbors at the time were complaining because our...
This is in Philadelphia where you
were.
Yeah,
it was in Pennsylvania.
And you had what in your backyard?
We had free-range chickens. Mm-hmm. And so our neighbors didn't really like that. So she said, well, a goat is definitely not going to work.
No.
So when we signed the papers for our farm in Indiana, I said, hey, Mom, you owe me a goat. So
definitely owe me. So you get two, Nan and Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
And are they like... They're like pets. They like follow you around.
They're like
and
puppies.
If you go around the corner, what do?
They start bleeding.
They start crying. And
yeah, they
where
cry.
Where are you?
Oh, yeah.
It's so sweet. I know your love of animals has brought you to volunteer at a veterinary clinic nearby. What do you get to do there? I mean, are you just cleaning out cages or are you doing stuff?
Well, I do a lot of stuff like cleaning out cages and walking dogs. But I also have gotten to witness a bunch of life-changing things at the veterinary clinic. And I have gotten to assist and observe numerous surgeries, including tumor and mass removals, as well as like inserting rods into the broken femurs of dogs and stuff.
Wow.
So that was really, really interesting.
So you're really there. And you look excited about it, not grossed out by it. So that might be something you might do. I know you're not just interested in animal well-being. You're very engaged in human well-being as well.
Yeah, I'm really into music therapy. And this passion was started by my second harp teacher. Her name is Sarah Jane Williams. And her focus in the harp world was on bringing the harp to nursing homes to use its healing powers through music therapy. And so she really got me started with bringing my harp to the nursing homes. And I would bring my harp from room to room to the elderly patients who couldn't get out of their rooms. So instead of just bringing my harp to the auditorium where tons of people could listen to it, I brought it from room to room for the people who really needed the music the most. And I found that harp is really a refuge for me. And through music therapy, it can be a refuge for others as well.
For others. I mean, because there's a whole universe of expression in what you do on the harp, and it completely would open up a world to somebody shut in, mm-hmm. and it's so wonderful of you to do that. And I'm sure it's a great source of solace to all that you play for. I know it was a great pleasure for us to hear you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katie. Katie Cappelson, 15 years old, from Bloomfield, Indiana. Next up, a fantastic teenage string quartet, all girls, all from the area around Columbus, Ohio, and all outstanding musicians. They call themselves Quartet Toujours, and they're rising stars in the youth music world, having just won the Midwest Young Artists Chamber Music Competition in Chicago and the St. Paul String Quartet Competition in Minnesota. They are Hee-yun Chung, 18 years old, Kaho Sugiwara, 17 years old, violinists, Eva Kennedy, 16-year-old violist, and Ruthie Cordray, our 18-year-old cellist. Hee-yun is at the mic. Hee-yun, would you tell everyone what you're going to play for us?
We'll be playing Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 3, Third Movement.
Quartet Toujours for teenagers studying at the Chamber Music Connection in Columbus, Ohio. Hee-yun Chung and Kaho Sugiwara, violins. Eva Kennedy, viola. And Ruthie Cordray, cello. You guys are such rock stars.
Oh.
That was like such amazing Shostakovich, and just amazing, just blows you away the cohesiveness of your ensemble and the musical thinking, just totally on track.
Thank you.
We try.
Really nice.
A little bit.
And fun too, which is saying a lot for such a dark piece like that one. My gosh.
Oh yeah.
So you guys are absolutely amazing, but sad to say, this is probably one of your last performances because Ian and Ruthie and Kaho, you're all off to college next year. Ruthie, you and Ian went on a college tour together, right?
This is true, actually. We took a week off from school and went around the East Coast to a bunch of different schools, and kind of in the same vein as Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle, we named it Hian and Ruthie Do College. So we had this kind of adventure where we met some cute boys and saw some
That's
cool
right.
schools. And
oh, gosh. Hian, I understand, Hian, you wanted to use our precious airtime to say hello to some very special people that you met
or wish
you had met along the way.
So we were on the Amtrak train coming from New York to Rochester, and there was this boy, that was very Ruthie.
Okay, he had like really pale skin and curly hair, and like not like we like Twilight or anything, because that's kind of
lame. Much,
but he looked like a vampire. He was seriously marvelous, like marvelous. And Hian, I'm supposed to say this because she gets embarrassed about it. He hit on her, and she found out that his name is Doug, and he lives in Erie, Pennsylvania.
And
so every time we're driving up to Cleveland and we see the Erie, Pennsylvania sign, we're like, Doug! And he's a computer programmer. So
if you're out there somewhere on Facebook world, please Facebook friend us.
If you know what I mean.
Gosh.
God, this is lame. Okay.
So sorry to have to turn the subject all serious now, but... I want to talk about practicing. Because in reading about you all, I discovered that your parents, mostly your moms, all had really different ways of getting you to stick with your music. I mean, this is something that our listeners ask about all the time. So how do I keep my kid focused on music? And the four of you are just exemplary products of all the possible approaches to that problem. Hian, your mom was all about tough love, right?
Yeah, my mom... was
Tiger Mother.
Yeah, like Ruthie says. that article.
If you've read that book.
Yeah. So I started violin when I was in third grade, and when I first started, I wasn't the most diligent student. So she made me practice about an hour a day all the time, even if I wanted to go off and play outside. But as I got older and I started to enjoy violin and I started to get better at it, my mom didn't have to tell me to practice anymore. And I really appreciated that. She kept me going, and now she hasn't told me to practice in... I don't know how many, a lot of years, so.
You're motivated. How about your mom, Kaho?
Well, my mom was quite the opposite of Hian. Well, I started playing the violin in third grade when my elementary school music teacher came up to me after class and was like, hey, you want to play the violin? And I was like, sure. And so neither me nor my mom really took it seriously for the first couple of years. It was more of like a new hobby, like a new thing to keep me distracted so I don't like go off playing video games or something. Mm-hmm.
But you've worked into it, obviously. Mm-hmm. Clearly, it's paying off. My gosh. Ruthie, was your situation like Kaho's situation?
Well, I mean, I guess kind of as a person in terms of motivation, I'm very different than that. Like, I have always pushed myself. So my parents always kind of let me just discover what it was that I was passionate about. But though they didn't encourage me to play music at first, they did encourage me to love it. And I've had music playing in my home since I was born, pretty much. My dad, when my mom was in the delivery room, went out and bought a stereo system for my room. Left her there. No, but... so I've had classical music, and my dad and I are huge fans of old jazz, like Chet Baker, Art Tatum. We listen to all the good stuff, Duke Ellington. So I guess I started playing piano by ear when I was two or three, kind of in between the two, I guess. And I picked up the cello in second grade, and I guess that's... history.
Love affair, yeah. Now, Eva, I have to say that your mom's approach may have been the most original, so original that we asked her to describe it.
So I designed this board game. We called it Caterpillar, Caterpillar. Each segment represented a different song. When she played the song, she would have a random particular challenge, such as a straight bowing or perfect notes or good posture or fingers. And if she was able to accomplish that, which she always did, then she would spin for a random prize. It really got her excited. It kept her focused. And when she got to the end of the caterpillar, which took her about 12 days, she would get a larger prize, such as movie tickets or a sleepover party, something like that.
Yeah, my mom did the board games, and I think it's great. Whenever anyone asks me how I practiced when I was young, I always bring it up, because it really got me psyched and it got me excited about practicing. But yeah, I would take classes with other students, and I thought everybody had board games like I did. And when I just thought that's how it was, and when I found out that other people didn't practice with them, I was astounded. I didn't know why they even practiced. I didn't know what the point was. So...
Well, you are all testaments to great practicing and great skills and great inspiration, your teachers, and, of course, let's not forget your coach, Debbie Price.
We love you, Debbie.
And we're going to see you all later on when you come back to play with Michael Feinstein. So we'll look forward to that. And bravo again.
Thank you.
Quartet Toujours from Columbus, Ohio.
For anyone convinced that classical music is dead, Nick Romeo's book Driven is refreshing proof to the contrary, says the New York Phil's Glenn Dichterow. Follow six From the Top alums as they make their way in the music world. Pick it up at fromthetop.org/driven.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. From the Poetry Foundation, celebrating 100 years of Poetry Magazine, online at poetryfoundation.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
From NPR, it's From the Top, celebrating the energy of America's kids and the power of classical music. This week, we're coming to you from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, Indiana. Coming up, special guest Michael Feinstein sings Gershwin accompanied by our kids. From the Top's home is New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall in Boston, where talented young musicians are creating a new century of musical excellence. Special thanks this week to radio station WFYI. Here again is Christopher O'Reilly.
Our next young performer is actually from here in Carmel. He's an outstanding 17-year-old bassoonist. Please welcome Tom English. Tom, tell everyone what you and I are going to play together.
We're going to be playing the first movement of Hummel's Bassoon Concerto in F major.
So this is probably from your, would you say, your favorite era of classical music? Hummel lived same time as who?
Yeah, I really like the classical romantic era, especially Beethoven is another one of my favorites.
Contemporary. All right, let's do this. Thank you. Tom English, 17-year-old bassoonist from here in Carmel, Indiana. Really great. You know, Hummel is not a composer that we think of quite in the same sort of breath of greatness as Beethoven, but he was certainly popular in his time, and he certainly, you know, brought everything to this concerto. Mm-hmm. I mean, my gosh, really wonderful.
Yeah.
Really great stuff. And Tom, you are a self-described perfectionist. I know this does not only apply to your bassoon playing, but to other things as well.
Yeah, I guess everything I do, I kind of have a perfectionistic quality that I try to apply to it. But most of all, I think, is golf. I was a really avid golfer before I got into music. So I think all the hours that I spent on the driving range, practicing and trying to be perfect, I think that really carried over to my musical career.
You're a perfectionist when you listen to others play, too. Tell everybody about one of the reasons the Berlin Philharmonic is your favorite orchestra.
Well, besides, you know, they're one of the best orchestras in the world, of course.
Gold standard.
Yeah, and I never really feel like they're going to make a mistake, so that's always reassuring.
It's not even on the table with the Berlin Philharmonic.
Exactly.
I don't think mistake is actually a word in German, actually.
Exactly.
What about when you attend live concerts yourself, friends or local groups, orchestras, what have you? Are you concentrating on all the wrong notes that are going to happen, or?
Well, you know, I try to listen to how they interpret the music and how, well, I'll just put it this way. It's really hard for me to not focus on mistakes, as bad as that may sound.
It happens. You know, piano tuners do nothing but sit in a concert hall and listen to the piano go south, you know, during the course of an hour and a half, and that's all they can concentrate on. Sometimes it's just your point of view. But let's have some fun with this and test just how good you are at catching mistakes. Follow me over to the piano here. Now, the piano literature isn't what you know best, but you said you love Beethoven, so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to play some passages from Beethoven, complete with a wrong note, and you tell me if you can catch the mistake. Don't worry, the first one's going to be sort of easy, okay? Did you hear?
Sorry.
Anything sound funny to you, Tom?
You know, there was one little spot in there.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought it was sort of an improvement, you know? I mean, you're sitting here for a whole measure. Why not mix it up a little bit? Oh, okay. You're right. You caught it. All right. You know what? I'm going out of your comfort zone, but I have a feeling you're going to be able to figure out the wrong note in this one.
Okay. I don't think that was right.
Oh. I guess it's all supposed to be an A minor, not an A major. Well, you're a sharp man. You're a hard man to fool, Tom, and you're a great collaborator. Made me very nervous wondering about wrong notes while I was playing with him. Great playing with you, and best of luck in all of your things.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Tom English, 17 years old, from here in Carmel, Indiana.
Podcasts of From the Top are available every week at fromthetop.org. Over the last 5 years, From the Top and the Jack Kent Cook Foundation have awarded well over $1 million in scholarships to talented young musicians who have financial need. We still have more to give. Go to fromthetop.org to learn more.
And now it's time for that treat we've been promising. Sitting in our audience is the artistic director of the Center for the Performing Arts. I could tell you that this charming guy happens to be one of the greatest interpreters of all time of the Great American Songbook, and that his 200-plus concerts a year have taken him from the White House to Buckingham Palace, that he's a dedicated preservationist of the legacy of American song. But I thought the teenage women of Quartet Toujours could do a better job.
Oh my God, his voice is so beautiful. It sounds like peanut butter.
When he sings, I just melt. And not just that, when I hear his voice, I want to get married.
My mom will actually die if she gets to meet him.
And we get to accompany him.
This is going to be on my resume forever.
I'm afraid I'm going to get lost in my music because I'll be listening to him too much. He's so amazing.
Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Feinstein. Welcome. And I wish I could get introductions like that. And we didn't write that, by the way. We just kind of collated that from their outpouring of admiration and anticipation of your being here. And it's great
to
have you.
I'm very touched.
As you know, Michael, this show is all about young musicians, but you've got a great childhood and teenage story. First of all, while our kids talk all the time about their teachers and their lessons, you didn't really take formal lessons at all.
No, I started playing by ear at the age of 5, and I sat down and played the piano with both hands. I played Do Re Mi from The Sound of Music, and as soon as I started playing, my mother insisted that somebody had taught me, and when I insisted nobody had, she sent me to my room for lying. So I immediately connected music with pain, and I was going to say have ever since, but that's not true.
I was amazed to learn that your lifelong fascination with collecting recordings and music from the golden age of American song began when you were the age of the kids on our show. How did that start?
I started having a fascination for old music and discovered some records in my uncle's basement that were 78s, and my parents explained to me what 78s were, and my dad then took me to secondhand stores in Goodwill, and I would buy these 78s for a nickel apiece, 20 for a dollar, and I just started discovering all this ancient music, and I wanted to know where it came from. I wanted to know who wrote it. I wanted to know about the artists and the vintage of it. I just always had a curiosity about what I was hearing, and that grew into this sort of obsessive collection and became a very important part of my life.
Yeah. Then, after your teenage years researching the lives of George and Ira Gershwin, after painstakingly collecting recordings of all sorts from that era, a dream came true for you. You moved to L.A. at the age of 20 and became Ira Gershwin's archivist, and more than that, his friend and confidant. But when did you start singing? I mean, when did you realize that you were going to be more than a pianist and archivist, that you were actually going to sing these amazing songs?
I started singing when I was probably 17. I was playing in a nightclub. I graduated from high school, and because I couldn't read music and I didn't know what I wanted to do with music, I started playing in nightclubs. And my parents actually said, "That's wonderful, honey. We're happy for you," which was odd, to put it mildly. But I started singing because somebody asked me to sing a song that I was playing, and I had to figure out how to sing while I was playing the piano. I had to figure out how to accompany myself, and that was the hardest thing that I ever did. But somehow, over a period of several months, I figured out how to do it, and it turned out to be one of the most important things that I could have possibly learned because it gave me a career.
Nice work if you can get it, right?
And you can get it if you try.
Tell everybody what you're going to sing for us to take us out.
Well, we're all going to do a song that was one of the last... It was the second to the last song that George and Ira Gershwin wrote, written for the Goldwyn Follies. I chose it because George Gershwin always called this melody his Brahmsy melody, and I thought it would be a wonderful thing to perform with piano and string quartet.
It's really beautiful. We're looking forward to it. So take your place, and I'm going to sign off here. In addition to the Toujours Quartet from Michael's own hometown of Columbus, Ohio, I'll have the honor of being at the piano. This is a fantastic way to end our show. I want to thank all our great performers, and thank you all for listening. This is Christopher O'Reilly. Please join me next week. And now, Michael, take it from the top.
Nothing seemed to matter anymore. Didn't care what I was headed for. Time was standing still. Nothing counted here. came a knock, knock, knocking at my door. Love walked right in and drove the shadows away. Love walked right in and brought my sunny day. One magic moment, and my heart seemed to know that love said hello, though not a word was spoken. One look, and I forgot. At last, one look, and I had found a world completely new. When love walked in with you,
From the Top is written and produced by Tom Vagley for Tom Vagley Productions, with Tim Banker for From the Top. Musical direction by Tom Vinieri with Caroline Cardius-Menos. Our tour producer is David Balsam. Our production manager is Elizabeth DeVore. Technical direction by Barrett Ouellette with David Forbes and John Servies. The executive producers are Gerald Slavin and Jennifer Hurley-Wales. I'm Joanne Robinson. The arrangement of Love Walked In was by Lee Blasky. From the Top is produced in association with WGBH Boston. Our home and educational partner is New England Conservatory in Boston. To download an application to appear on our program, visit fromthetop.org.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and health care, on the web at rwjf.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Thanks for downloading this week's From the Top podcast. If you liked what you heard, head over to our website, fromthetop.org, where you can listen to every show in its entirety. I'm Christopher O'Reilly. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again next week.